Hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Morning and welcome to this session of the 11th Circuit. Judge Newsom, Judge Choflat, and I were supposed to be in Jacksonville this week, and hopefully we'll return to live court sometime in the future if things get better with the vaccinations and the positivity rate for the COVID infection. But we've been having these arguments by Zoom, and they've been working relatively well given the circumstances. So we hope that that'll be the case this week too. You all know the drill. We obviously don't have a clock with light for you, but we do have a timer on the corner of the screen so you can see what time you have left. Ms. Geddes will also let you know when you have 2 minutes left in your argument. If we take you beyond the clock, don't worry, you're on our time and not yours, and we'll keep going until we finish with our questions. As Chief Judge Pryor likes to say, we've read your briefs, certain portions of the record and the authority cited, and so we're pretty comfortable with a general understanding of your cases, but you obviously know them much better than we do, and that's why we're here, so you can help us figure them out. With that, we'll begin with case number 19-11333, United States versus Nadine Bromfield Alexander and Shamir Hassan. And Mr. Wander, you're up first. Your mute button is still on.
Sorry. Good morning, Your Honors, Judge Jordan Newsom and Choflat. I'm Jason Wandner. May it please the court. We are here on Shamir Hassan's appeal. I will focus beginning of my remarks on issue 3, the identity theft jury instruction under 18 U.S.C. 1028. The trial judge in this case read over defense objection, the standard 11th Circuit jury instruction on identity theft that had recently been amended at the time of this trial. The new standard instruction added a word that rendered the defendant's theory of defense in this case and the jury instruction itself illegitimate as it related to him. And in fact, on the government's brief in this matter, page 66, they confirmed that word and that modification of the instruction was intended for not him, but his co-defendant. But as to him, it expanded the reach of the statute by including the word illegitimate when the statute criminalized use of personal information in an underlying unlawful conduct, whereas the jury instruction states the government is required to prove the defendant transferred, possessed, or used the other person's means of identification for an unlawful or illegitimate purpose. Adding the word illegitimate in this jury instruction directly impacted the defendant's theory of defense in this case, whereby he argued that while he may have broken or violated Jamaica Bank rules or regulations helping people send money, there is no evidence in this case that he participated in the lottery fraud. And in fact, the fraudsters deliberately kept him in the dark. Moreover, there's no evidence he participated in stealing identities or that he knew the identities were stolen.
Wonder, is that, you say there's no evidence, but you mean no direct evidence, right?
There is no direct evidence. And in fact, the government, for all intents and purposes, confirmed that he was kept in the dark. They did obtain the deliberate ignorance instruction and argued that he both knew and didn't know. The evidence on that is, we argued, insufficient. But either way, the instruction on the jury instruction relating to really where the evidence in the case lied against my client was overwhelmingly in relation to the identity theft and the evidence that he used identities to assist in the transfer of money. But as we argued, that could have been done as part of another kind of crime involving drugs or something else, which would not have implicated him in a lottery fraud, or it could have been him assisting people with legitimate sources of income overcome very strict bank regulations. And that all came out during the trial and was part of the evidence in the case.
Can I ask you a question? This is Judge Newsom. So, but didn't the judge instruct the jury as well that Hassan, that the government had to show that Hassan's transfer, possession, use of another person's means of identification was, quote, during and in relation to a felony violation of 18 U.S.C. 1349?
Judge, he did say that.
Does that square up with your theory that the addition of the phrase or illegitimate must have expanded liability beyond unlawfulness?
Similar to the Onspaugh case, Judge, which I cited in my brief 792 F 3rd 1302 from this court in 2015.
Counsel, 2 minute warning.
Thank you. The Onspaugh case involved a honest services fraud instruction. While the standard did have the normal standard fraud instructions, it was the follow-up instructions that expanded the use of the honest services fraud to include not only kickbacks, but also underlying interest, which had been specifically prohibited by the Skillings decision. And so it's not necessarily sufficient just to have the basic elements. It's those descriptive and definitive parts of the instructions, like in the Onspaugh case, and like in this case, that is what the jurors look to define what the elements and the regular jury instructions are. So in this case, when they see that the defense posited by the defendant is that he may have acted illegitimately, but not unlawfully, that instruction, in essence, poisoned the well and prevented him from being able to thrust his legitimate defense. And so while the court did instruct on the basic standards, the addition of the use of the word illegitimate, similar to the illegitimate instruction in Onspaugh, prevented Mr. Hassan from getting the full thrust of his defense. In addition, Judge, Your Honors, the evidence in the case was, despite the assertions, there was no evidence that Mr. Hassan ever, in fact, profited. While there was testimony that he obtained extra money, they never found any throughout all their forensic review. And in fact, there was testimony that whatever monies he got was for the courtesy of doing the transfers without them being in person. And in fact, the only evidence really of the deliberate ignorance issue is testimony that came out in cross-examination where the main co-defendant—
The argument has expired.
Thank you. May I finish thoughts?
You can finish up. Yes, of course.
Thank you, Your Honor. Whereas in cross-examination of the main co-defendant, he indicated that he had an unwritten agreement, an unspoken agreement. Don't tell me no lies. Don't ask me any questions. I won't tell you no lies. In fact, that was severely impeached because he had never made that statement in any of his prior statements to the investigators or in any of the 302s. It came out, could honestly, out of left field during his cross-examination. And the government's brief suggests that's the most powerful evidence of his deliberate ignorance. So in fact, there was no evidence that he had any knowledge of this. This could have been him helping people using legitimate source of income, try to evade the strict bank rules. And under those basis, Your Honors, that jury instruction, as well as the other issues we've raised, really violated Mr. Hassan's ability to obtain a fair trial.
Very much, Mr. Wander. You saved your time for rebuttal.
Thank you,
Mr. Bashir.
Thank you. May it please the court, and good morning, Your Honors. Adil Bashir on behalf of Ms. Alexander. I'd like to first begin with the vulnerable victim enhancement. And there's two points I'd like to make, both of which stem and flow from understanding Mrs. Alexander's role in this conspiracy. So to set the stage, the conspiracy here has two parts. One aspect is targeting, soliciting, and scamming individuals in order to obtain money. And the second part, which is the part all of the evidence linking Ms. Alexander to is the money laundering aspect of this conspiracy and the part your honors were just discussing with my colleague. Here on the vulnerable victim enhancement, the district court said, and I would quote, this is on pages 97 and 98 of the sentencing transcript, and again on 115, that the vulnerable victim enhancement was applied because primarily because of the trial testimony linking Ms. Alexander to the victims. However, there is no testimony, and as Your Honor was just mentioning, direct or circumstantial, that ties Ms. Alexander to any of these victims. In fact, there's affirmative evidence that shows Ms. Alexander was not present during the phone calls. She did not participate in the phone calls. She did not overhear any of the phone calls. The PSR even reflects as much in footnote one, indicating that Ms. Alexander was not and did not make any of the phone calls to the victims themselves. So really, when we understand this fraud from these two different aspects, on the one hand, the solicitation, and on the other hand, the running aspect, we see a clear disconnect when it comes to the vulnerable victim enhancement, because there is no linkage between what the district court is citing in terms of the trial testimony and Ms. Alexander itself. And I think there's—
Mr. Bashir, just a quick question. Does our case law require that sort of specific linkage between the defendant and the victims that you're talking about? I mean, I thought our case law said that at least whereas here there is evidence, you can dispute the sufficiency of the evidence, I guess, but where there's evidence to show that the defendant was pretty deeply involved in the conspiracy, that the district court can fairly infer that the defendant understands that the victims are vulnerable.
So two responses to that, to the legal aspect of the level of specificity, and I believe the Day case does show that there needs to be a finding that not just a general understanding of the conspiracy itself, but that Ms. Alexander, there's a specific finding that she understands the types of victims. To the second half of what we're of what the district court and how the district court is inferring, as Your Honor was saying, the inference here really is the problem, because the inference is expressly made from the fact that Ms. Alexander was present at the apartment where these calls were being made. That's what that is the testimony that the district court is relying on. But when you really dig down and look at that trial testimony, the government even concedes there is no trial testimony that Ms. Alexander was present during these calls. Contextually speaking, she's the girlfriend of the kingpin and was at the home itself. And a really important aspect of this is there was two interrelated enhancements. One was the vulnerable victim, the other was the misrepresentation of government agencies. And the district court did not find that Ms. Alexander had that knowledge. And we know from the trial testimony that when callers called victims, for example, Mr. Noss, that cited, the callers said they were from IRS agencies or other government agencies. So if Ms. Alexander is unaware of that aspect, which she presumably also would have overheard, it would surely follow that she did not have the same sufficient knowledge to understand the types of victims. And that really circles back to the first point Your Honor was making, the level of specificity. It's not enough for her to know that calls
were being made. 2 minute warning.
Thank you. And it's not enough that she understands that perhaps there are victims in Jamaica, but that these victims are vulnerable and the types of victims that are being targeted. Yes, Your Honor.
What time can you establish knowledge? Can the government establish knowledge for this enhancement? In other words, does it have to be when she first becomes a part of the scheme? Or can the government try to show that she gained the knowledge, maybe even towards the end of the scheme before it all fell apart? Or does it matter?
I think a fair reading of the case law is that knowledge could be established at any point of her participation in the conspiracy. And since this is a conspiracy case before she had withdrawn here, though, whether to Your Honor's last point, it doesn't matter here, because at no point in the conspiracy, whether before, during, or after, is there a single piece of evidence that Ms. Alexander is even in the room when these calls are being made, let alone that she's overheard the calls. And in the sentencing transcript, the government's witnesses expressly said there was no trial testimony that she was present during the phone calls. The PSR reflects the same. And even if you look very carefully at the sentencing court's findings, again, 97, 98, and on 115 of the sentencing transcript, the sentencing court is citing Ms. Alexander's involvement in identity theft, wire fraud, and opening credit cards. And the only piece of evidence, and I would quote this, is the calls being made from the premises. So the inference here is that because calls are being made, one, Ms. Alexander, I see my time is expiring, if I can just finish this.
No, go ahead and conclude, please.
That Ms. Alexander, one, overhears the call, of which we have no evidence. And number two, she overhears specifically the types of victims that are being targeted. And since we know she did not even hear that the callers were misrepresenting themselves, the inference that she could hear on the other end, the types of victims, is far beyond what the day case would allow in this instance. I see my time has expired, unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bashir. You've saved your time for rebuttal as well.
Thank you.
Ms. Sweeney.
Good morning, Your Honors and counsel. May it please the court. My name is Sarah Sweeney on behalf of the United States. I'll begin with the vulnerable victim issue that Ms. Alexander kept focused on during her argument here, or Mr. Bashir's argument here. But in any event, here, the district court, in both of its sentencing determinations that are at issue here, but in particular as to this one, focused on three factors. It focused on the amount, the different ways that Ms. Alexander promoted the conspiracy that showed that she had agreed to the full scope of the conspiracy. It focused on the length of her involvement in the conspiracy, that her known active involvement in the conspiracy, and it focused on her proximity to the fraud that was going on. So I'll start with the last one, with the proximity, because I think it most closely ties to what Mr. Bashir argued here. And that is, yes, there is no direct evidence that Ms. Alexander heard a call or was present for a call. But what there is evidence of is that she was present at different apartments where multiple of the conspirators lived. And there was ongoing fraud in those apartments, including calls made by Mr. Maduri and Mr. LaPalme to victims. While most of the people involved in these conspiracies were not involved in contact with victims, those two conspirators did call victims. And then two of the other conspirators, Morris and Stewart, stated that they came to understand the nature of the conspiracy merely by hearing Mr. Maduri make these calls. From that evidence, it's a fair inference by the district court that Ms. Alexander, from her proximity, would also have been able to understand the nature of the fraud. And as the district court noted, some of these victims were called again and again and again. And as a
Ms. Sweeney, what were the contents of those calls that would have placed somebody who heard them from the outside on notice about the fact that they were targeting vulnerable victims?
Well, Your Honor, I think that you could, the district court could infer that you could tell from the nature of the conversations that they were targeting vulnerable victims. For instance, Mr. Kornfeld's family talked about how the calls preyed on him and tried to establish these personal relationships. And that would be something
but
that you could hear.
But any fraud victim is preyed upon.
Your Honor, I think here the inference would be that the attempt at the personal connection and the way that they called the same people over and over to build familiarity, that's the
that doesn't make, but that doesn't make a victim vulnerable.
It doesn't.
A lot of schemes build on fostering these relationships of trust so that then you can, you know, defraud them, unfortunately. But it doesn't mean that the victim is vulnerable within the meaning of the guideline, right?
Not by itself, Your Honor, but I think if they fall victim to it, yes. I think Day says that reloading and being able to have that actually be effective does make a victim vulnerable. But I want to contend, I understand Your Honor's point. And I think the other side here is that Ms. Alexander doesn't have to know that the victims are vulnerable. The district court also relied on the fact that she should have known they were vulnerable. And that does not depend as much on actually hearing and understanding the content of the calls, but instead understanding the nature of the conspiracy. And the district court found that it was part of the efficient operation of the conspiracy to be able to repeatedly target these vulnerable victims. And as a result of her full agreement to the scope of the conspiracy, it therefore found correctly that she should have known that there were vulnerable victims as well. I would also just like to briefly address the idea that there are two linked enhancements. As Mr. Bashir said, the district court did find that she should not be held accountable for the misrepresentations on behalf of a government agency, that Ms. Alexander should not be held accountable for that. There's two points I just would make quickly about that. One is, just because the district court didn't find her accountable for that doesn't mean that it couldn't have, based on the evidence that Mr. Bashir said, which is that Mr. Nas did say that he had been contacted by the IRS. But even more than that, most of the evidence about the misrepresentations on behalf of government agencies actually came from Mr. Maduri's computer. They were written communications. They were letters that the conspirators sent to some of the victims. And that's, given the necessity of the proximity, that's something Ms. Alexander could not be fairly inferred to have heard, because it occurred in a different way for many of the victims. I'll now address Mr. Hassan's counsel's arguments about his conviction. And in particular, I'll start with the ID theft instruction. The word illegitimate here applies only to the second element of the offense. And it simply informs the jury that the information does not need to be stolen in order for someone to be convicted of aggravated identity theft. And here, Mr. Hassan, says that this instruction undercut his defense, but it didn't, because he still argued that all he had done was violate Jamaican Nationals policies, and the jury clearly rejected that argument.
This doesn't mean that Mr. Wander is right in this case, but it's enough. It's not enough to say that a defendant was able to argue something to a jury if a jury instruction really precluded the jury from considering that argument and giving effect to it, right?
You are right. And that's where I was going, Your Honor. Here, even that point, I think, is amplified. My point that he was able to effectively argue this is amplified by the third element of the aggravated identity theft instruction, which tells the jury that the use, possession, or transfer, beyond being the person having illegitimate access to the identity information, has to be during and in relation to a felony offense. And given the presumption that juries follow the instructions that are given to them, here there was no impediment to the defense being made to the jury, because this jury instruction accurately covered the nature of the charge.
Let me ask you a more general question. We've got to obviously write an opinion on this case, and part of it is going to focus on the use of the word illegitimate in the instruction and the pattern instruction. Does that word have any role to play in a case where a defendant charged with aggravated identity theft was initially in lawful possession of someone else's identity documents?
Absolutely, it does, Your Honor. That's precisely what it can apply in different ways. So one would be where someone accesses identity information beyond the scope of their authorized ability to access it. So for instance, someone working at the DMV who has access, lawful access to the information, but exceeds that access. Another way that I saw illegitimate described in the case law, and this is in the Flores-Figueroa case from the Supreme Court, they describe potential illegitimate uses of identity information, including by things like dumpster diving, where information has been discarded, but someone then goes and retrieves it. That wasn't necessarily unlawful, but their continued possession and use of it was illegitimate, and then in furtherance of a felony offense. So that was discussed in the Flores-Figueroa case as well. So there are a number of ways that someone can possess, use, or transfer this information illegitimately rather than necessarily unlawfully from the outset. And then Mr. Wadner also discussed the deliberate ignorance instruction for a period of time in his argument. And I want to respond particularly to one thing he said. He said that this was an unspoken agreement between Mr. Maduri, one of the main co-conspirators, and Mr. Hassan. The evidence at trial was that it was not unspoken. It was explicit. Mr. Maduri testified that he and Mr. Hassan had in fact explicitly agreed that Mr. Hassan would not ask about the source of the funds. And that evidence is really more than sufficient to support the giving of a deliberate ignorance instruction. It falls precisely within what the nature of that instruction is, that someone's put on notice that something is wrong and then deliberately omits to ask any further questions. On the other hand, there was sufficient evidence as well. The jury had kind of two theories of responsibility for knowledge that it could find here. The other was actual knowledge. And Mr. Hassan was not directly informed of the nature of the funds, but he received repeated trainings and warnings, and even specific warnings to him from Jamaica National, the money transmitting company that he worked with, that the activities he was doing ran the risk of being part of a lottery scam. So as a result of that,
in all my years here, I can say to a fair degree of certainty that almost all of these deliberate ignorance instruction cases result in the government arguing harmless error on appeal because the evidence overwhelmingly showed direct and actual knowledge and not just deliberate ignorance. So that you can never get to a deliberate ignorance issue because the government is saying, we didn't really need that instruction, we proved actual knowledge. Tell me about that. I mean, if the government can prove actual knowledge, why does it want or why does it need a deliberate ignorance instruction? And why does the government generally fail to defend it and argue harmless error?
So, Your Honor, we obviously do argue harmless error on this point in our brief. But I can't comment on every case where we do this. But in this case in particular, I mean, I don't know that I've seen another case where there was testimony about an explicit agreement not to ask questions. That to me seems to justify a deliberate ignorance instruction, regardless of whether there was also proof of actual knowledge, which obviously we do think there was here. But I mean, yes, it is harmless error because there is proof of actual knowledge, but I would say the evidence of that from which the jury could find deliberate ignorance is particularly strong here. I think it's rare. I wouldn't say it obvious. Obviously, it's happened before in the canons of criminal law, but it's rare that there's a direct and explicit agreement on that point. I guess the final point I'll make on that is that Mr. Wadner said that testimony was impeached in some way, definitely Mr. Maduri was questioned about it. I don't think that it's fair to say that it was strongly impeached, but regardless of whether it was or wasn't, in terms of a sufficiency of the evidence sort of issue, all the inferences are drawn in favor of the jury's verdict. So that impeachment does not have any impact on the convictions here. So, Your Honors, I think I've addressed counsel's arguments. If the court has any other questions, I'm happy to answer them, or I'm happy to yield the rest of my time. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Sweeney. Mr. Wadner.
Yes, Your Honors. May it please the court. Briefly on the jury instruction relating to identity theft, the instructions as read did not limit itself to the second element, and that's critical. Because while they may argue that it was related to the second element and therefore to Ms. Alexander, the instructions did not explain that in any way, shape, or form. So the jury was free to utilize it in whatever way they chose. And again, it clearly impacted negatively on defendant Hassan's theory of defense. Regarding deliberate ignorance, Judge, your honors can review the jury's
examination. Wander, you're sort of bleeding out. So if you could just face the microphone, we'll be able to hear you.
I'm so sorry, your honor. Your honors can review Mr. Maduri's testimony on that issue. It's on page 278 of document 376. And clearly he never mentioned, even the government acknowledged in its examination of him on this issue, that he never told the agents that there was this explicit agreement, and none of the 302s established it. It was out of left field, and yet the government hangs its entire deliberate ignorance hat on this explicit agreement that was not part of the evidence until it was brought out of left field. And in fact, all of the testimony, your honors, of all the co-defendants throughout the case was that they went out of their way to prevent Mr. Hassan from having the information because they knew or concerned how he would react. And in fact, Jamaican National Bank, when they instructed Mr. Hassan, they instructed him by mailings and letters, no evidence that he in fact was personally instructed. And in fact, when they cut him off—
What about the volume? What about the volume of the transactions and the amounts, Mr. Wander? How does that play into the equation, if at all?
Yes, Your Honor, there was a significant volume of traffic. There's no doubt about that. There's no question.
Also, your argument has expired.
Go ahead and finish, Mr. Wander, of course.
Thank you. But again, Your Honor, if he did not have actual knowledge or deliberate ignorance of those transactions, then it's not a criminal act. It's a businessman doing his job. Even if he was evading restricted regulations, he did not have any awareness of the criminal nature. In fact, they kept it from him and they went out of their way to keep it from him because they were concerned about what he would do about it. In other words, if he were to ask them, they know that they would have lied. Then what? What is a businessman supposed to accept a lie or just not do any business whatsoever? That's the conundrum with deliberate ignorance. In this case, there is absolutely no evidence that he had actual knowledge or participated in any way. Yes, there was a lot of transactions, but no evidence that he had any knowledge that the victims were the identity theft victims were stolen. He had no part of that, nor that there was a lottery scheme at all. This could have been any other crime, and he wouldn't have been convicted of lottery scam or wire fraud. Or it could have been argued.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Thank you all very much, Mr. Bashir, Ms. Sweeney. We appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor, just two brief points here.
Bashir, I'm so sorry. I completely forgot about your rebuttal. My apologies. My apologies.
It's all right. Not a problem at all. Just two brief points. I won't hold you up.
You can have an extra minute.
It's okay. I was going to say I'm pretty used to people trying to get rid of me. I'm just kidding.
Hopefully not here.
No, I'm enjoying our time here. And I do want to just two brief points and pick up on a theme, Judge Jordan, that I think you hit the nail on the head when it comes to knowledge here and how the government really is trying to have it two ways. And as it specifically relates to Ms. Alexander, I bring the court back to the two aspects of this conspiracy, the solicitation and the running. And we know from conspiracy case law, you can be found guilty without having knowledge of the full scope. And here, and I can use my hand, the right hand doesn't necessarily need to know what the left hand is doing. And the theme I think we are hearing from both parties or all the parties this morning is the key players in this conspiracy were trying to keep the ancillary players, including Ms. Alexander, who was a minor role recipient, outside of what was going on. So the idea that Ms. Alexander knows every aspect, particularly the types of victims, and the most integral aspect, that this is a lottery scam to falsely represent the types of victims, really is a bridge too far. And the last point I'll just briefly make, Your Honor mentioned in all the years that you've been doing this, how the government is arguing deliberate ignorance and knowledge. It made me think, and a very common theme as well is in every case in which you have a minor role, particularly a significant other or girlfriend that's involved in the scheme, there's always a presumption, well, she should have known. But what's missing is the actual evidence of why she should have known. In fact, we know from here, the key players, Mr. Curlew, Mr. Mordier, et cetera, were deliberately keeping Ms. Alexander and others outside of the loop so as to insulate themselves. And we know that to be true because of the minor role enhancement. We know that to be true because of the misrepresentation. So in finding that by the preponderance, she should have known on the other end of the call, the types of victims, the district court did error and abused its discretion.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Bashir. Mr. Wander, Mr. Bashir, Ms. Sweeney, for the second time, thank you very, very much. We really appreciate the help.
Thank you very much.